It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, the Justice Department is reopening the murder case of Emmett Till. We talked to a historian about the news and the significance of Till's story to the civil rights movement. First, the latest Marquette University Law School poll came out yesterday. In addition to getting people's opinions on political races, tariffs, and Foxconn, it also asked Wisconsinites about the state of their roads. How to pay for those roads remains one of the toughest issues for state lawmakers to reach agreement on. Divides within the Republican Party on transportation funding delayed passage of the state budget for over 2 months last year, and now Democrats are hoping the issue could be a political winner for them in the election for governor this fall. Sean Johnson is WPR's Capital Bureau Chief. His series on transportation issues in the state last year was called Wisconsin Roads, a Turning Point. Sean, thanks for being back with us.
Thanks for having me.
Well, what did we learn from the Marquette Law School poll about how people feel about the roads?
So there was one question in there about roads, and it was, how would you rate the quality of roads and highways where you live? And in a poll that was otherwise marked by people who didn't really know what they thought, you know, like in the governor's primary, 38% of Democratic voters said they didn't know who they were going to vote for in that primary. 30% of Republican voters didn't know who they were going to vote for in the Republican primary for Senate. But when it came to roads, there was no undecided on how are the roads near you. And so what you saw on the statewide level was that 5% said excellent, 35% said good, 36% said fair, 23% said poor. So, I mean, if you're scoring that at home, fair and poor outweighed good and excellent.
And I understand it depended in part on where you live. There was a geographic split here, too.
Yeah, this is where it got kind of interesting. What they did was they broke up those answers into the Milwaukee and Madison media markets. So that's 21 counties in the southern half of the state. And then the northern half of the state. So, you know, Green Bay, Eau Claire, everywhere else, basically, 51 counties north of that Milwaukee-Madison block. And what they found is that in Milwaukee-Madison in southern southeast Wisconsin, 48% said excellent, good, 52% said fair, poor. So
even,
roughly
50-50,
even.
We
yeah,
could
you know,
call
there's
it.
There's a, that's within the margin of error for sure. In northern Wisconsin, though, only 34% said excellent slash good, 52% said fair, poor. So, you know, outside of southern Wisconsin and southeast Wisconsin, people think the roads are worse.
Could this be a political issue? Are Democrats trying to make this a political issue as we run up toward the November elections?
You hear them talk about it for sure. We don't know exactly what they're going to hammer home Scott Walker with until after the primary. It seems like right now there's an inclination to go after him on Foxconn more than on roads, potentially. It's just going to be a matter of kind of where they put their money. You know, does it make a better ad to talk about Foxconn than to talk about crumbling roads? Maybe they get paired and they talk about, you know, the government under Scott Walker was willing to give billions to this foreign corporation, but not to fixing roads. You can see that kind of thing developing, but they haven't really gone after the governor in a really big way in previous elections.
Now, Democrats know they're going to get votes in places like Madison and Milwaukee, and I think it seems like in some ways people are looking for candidates and issues to try to boost voting outside of those two metropolitan areas.
Yeah, I think if you look at the parts of the state that think their roads aren't great, it's the parts of the state where that could decide this election. So, you know, even the portion of the state that thinks their roads are better includes the, you know, the backbone of the Republican Party. I mean, southeast Wisconsin is where Governor Walker is going to get a sizable portion of his votes. Madison, Milwaukee is where the Democratic nominee is going to get a sizable portion of their votes. So they're looking to reach out to these other parts of the state. You know, the Green Bay media market is always critical. Western Wisconsin is critical. And so this is an issue that could potentially move people there, especially, you know, in the governor's race is one thing, but you could imagine this being an issue in a lot of state Senate races, for example, where, you know, there people are more hyper focused on road conditions in a specific district, maybe, and what one party did about it or didn't do.
Talking to WPR's Sean Johnson about roads, politics, and money in Wisconsin. And let's get to the money and politics side of this, Sean. We've talked about this a zillion times. plus or minus, in the last three, 4 years. People in the legislature, people around the state in public opinion surveys want better roads. There's a disagreement over how to pay for it, or even if there needs to be more revenue to pay for that.
Yeah, and we've been stuck on that kind of question for a number of years now. You know, ever since the state got rid of gas tax indexing, there's sort of been this slowly developing gap between what the state wants to spend on roads and what it can afford without more borrowing. Okay, gas tax indexing would increase the gas tax automatically to keep up inflation. The legislature didn't have to vote on it. The governor didn't have to sign it. But that was done away with under Governor Jim Doyle. So you do hear some calls to bring that back. You hear, for example, Malin Mitchell brings it up a lot. He's one of the Democrats running for governor. He says he'd bring back gas tax indexing. Other Democrats are generally supportive of some kind of a tax or fee for roads. But among Republicans, Governor Walker has taken kind of an increasingly hardline stand against increasing taxes or fees for roads. So it's a real, difference between him and between the field that's looking to defeat him.
And we saw a standoff among Republicans, really, in the last budget. You followed this a lot between, I guess, Governor Walker and Senate Republicans on one side, and then Assembly Republicans led by Robin Voss, who was really vocal on this on the other side, wanting something.
And that may be potentially, coming from where their members are from. Okay, so Assembly Republicans have a lot of members from rural Wisconsin, up in northern and western Wisconsin, in areas of the state where people say their roads aren't great. The idea of some kind of tax or fee was really killed in the Senate last year, and, you know, probably by a handful of Republican senators from southeast Wisconsin, where roads are generally viewed as better. So you kind of see that divide. You know, where we ended things was one of the last big ideas for revenue during the road funding debate came from Assembly Speaker Robin Voss, who was talking about a heavy trucking fee that went nowhere. I mean, that was killed pretty fast. After the budget debate was all over, Senate Majority Leader Scott Fitzgerald said, I think we have to do tolls in Wisconsin. That's the only way we're going to get this done, to get enough revenue to redo all the interstates, which are going to be so expensive. But again, that happened after the budget debate. Everybody had gone home. They're not coming back to Madison to talk about tolls. And even if they did, that's not something that they could start generating revenue from real quick, and they'd need the federal government's okay.
So what's going on now? There's highway funding, there's local road funding, there's county roads. Are we in a period of kind of triage? What do we need to fix now?
You do have some local governments that are going to a wheel tax. For example, Eau Claire County went to that to deal with county roads. You have decisions being made all over the state of Wisconsin, which, you know, we don't necessarily track or know about, in town boards, for example, where they have decided to maybe go to take some roadways that were asphalt for a number of years, and because they're in deteriorating condition, they grind them up and turn them into gravel. It's hard to say how widespread that is, but we know that that's happening. So because local governments depend so much on state funding, when that state funding isn't coming in as quickly, or it hasn't historically come in as quickly, and they're under revenue limits, they have to figure out how to get revenue on their own, or they have to cut back.
Bringing things back to the elections, we don't know what either party's main message is going to be. There's a lot of options, from, you know, opinions on the president of the United States, the future of abortion in the state with the U.S. Supreme Court in play. I could go on and on. Roads is just one of those. Do you really see that emerging as a likely theme?
It's hard to imagine what the storyline out of Washington is going to be as we get closer to the election, right? So it's hard to say whether Democrats are going, what they're going to want to say about President Trump, for example, might take precedence over what they want to say about roads. I think another outstanding question is, what role do the road builders and the road building lobby play in this year's elections? They've been willing to support Governor Walker in his first campaign for governor, for example. They have a lot of money. They could potentially get involved in a race in a more outspoken way against him, but that carries some risks for them, because if he wins, they're probably not going to get what they want in the next budget.
Sean, thanks a lot for joining us.
You're welcome.
Sean Johnson is WPR's Capital Bureau Chief. He is with us to talk about the latest numbers on how Wisconsinites feel about their roads and why lawmakers have a tough time agreeing on how to pay for them. After 63 years of being left unsolved, the Justice Department is reopening the murder case of Emmett Till, an African-American boy who was tortured and killed in Mississippi in 1955. Pictures of Till's mutilated body were seen around the country and the world, and the case is widely seen as a catalyst for the civil rights movement. Deborah Watts is Emmett Till's cousin and the co-founder of the Emmett Till Legacy Foundation. She told On Point this week what she wanted to see out of a new investigation.
I'm just hoping that with this continuation of the investigation, that there is justice for Emmett and that those responsible that are held accountable for their involvement.
Brenda Gale Plummer is a professor of history and African-American studies at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Brenda, thanks for joining us.
Oh, well, thank you for having me.
Now, what was your reaction to this news that the U.S. Justice Department is reopening Emmett Till's murder case?
Well, I'm certainly glad that they're taking another look at it, even after all of these years. Justice should prevail.
And a former UW-Madison professor, Tim Tyson, wrote a book on this. Some people are saying, hey, this led to the reopening of the case, but he says he doesn't have much faith in it. He thinks it's just for show, kind of to put a good light on the Justice Department. What do you make of that?
Well, there are several reasons why I think this is important, and I think some of it references to some of the issues that the country is going through right now. I believe that Professor Tyson had found out about this about 10 years ago. I'm not sure why the FBI is just taking it up now, but the fact remains that we're still dealing with some of the artifacts from the Jim Crow era in terms of how the country is going now.
Now, take us back to what happened to Emmett Till. Can you just briefly remind listeners what happened?
Sure. Emmett Till was a 14-year-old black boy from Chicago whose mother decided that he should spend the summer down south in Mississippi to get him away from the big bad city. While there, he was kidnapped, beaten to death, and dumped into a river by two white men who accused him of having insulted one of their wives. He was accused of having whistled at this woman. And then later at the trial of these two men, the woman in question, who has since admitted that she lied about it, said that he essentially had sexually assaulted her. The body was found in a terrible condition, but it was his mother, through her efforts, at deciding to have an open casket funeral that allowed people to see what had been done to him that made this a national case and gave additional energy to efforts to end segregation and racial violence.
Now, this wasn't the only murder of a black person in the South at this time. There were many cases of people killed, sometimes in broad daylight after voting, people killed in response to their actions to organize black voters. What was it about this particular case that captured, as you say, national, I think even international attention?
Right. One of the things that's important to note is that this was about a child, a 14-year-old boy. Now, black children in the South had historically been seen, primarily as units of labor. For example, in many places, the school year in the segregated black schools ended earlier than those in white schools because black kids were expected to go pick cotton, when the harvest was ready. We also find that almost 10 years, a little bit more than 10 years earlier than the Emmett Till case, the state of South Carolina actually electrocuted a 14-year-old boy, a 14-year-old black boy, on a trumped-up rape charge. And this kid was so small, that he barely fit into the electric chair and had to be shocked twice before he died. So the question is, well, what changed over this period? Well, for one thing, there was the Brown decision in 1954, a year before the Till case, in which the Supreme Court ordered the desegregation of public schools. So what we're seeing is a change in the view of black children. As you know, black children are now being considered people. They're now being considered children. And the requirements and needs of childhood are being recognized. Unfortunately, today, not so much. But that was the change that was occurring at that particular time.
Brenda Gale Plummer is with us, professor of history and African American studies at the UW-Madison, looking at the reopening of the investigation of the Emmett Till case from back in 1955, this announcement from the U.S. Department of Justice. Brenda, take us back to the aftermath. There was a trial of two white men accused of this murder. What happened?
Okay, well, they were acquitted by an all-white jury, which, again, given the circumstances of Mississippi in 1955, was not to be, was not unexpected. But once again, the injustice of the case did impress large numbers of people.
Did it inspire people to become active in the civil rights movement?
Yes. Mississippi was regarded as sort of the toughest case, the most obdurate case in the South. It would be some years before segregation practices and racial violence in that state were challenged, but it certainly brought to the world's attention what the inequities in that area were.
I know in your own research you've looked at international ties in efforts for civil rights around the world. Did this case, the Emmett Till case, inspire people from around the world to pay attention to what was going on here in the United States?
Yes. That case and many others, the critics of the United States with regard to its racial practices included the Soviet Union and the Warsaw Pact countries that were allied to the Soviet Union, but it also included America's allies, Western Europeans, and many people in the so-called Third World, the emerging new nations of Asia and Africa. The United States was concerned about where the allegiances of those people were going. And this was one of the impetus that the United States had to try to reform the racial policies that had so long been customary.
Do you think, looking back from the modern day, that in the public at large, we don't pay enough attention to this part of history, this what was in effect a large-scale domestic terror movement targeting mainly black Americans?
Well, no. I think that there's quite a bit of history that informs or could inform our understanding of what is taking place today. The case of the witness, Carolyn Bryant, who lied at the trial of the two men who killed Emmett Till, is part of a tradition in which the accusation of rape or sexual assault of white women by black men was generally used as an excuse to enact lynching and other forms of persecution of black people. Unfortunately, in today's world, we see with these wild black cases where we still have these false accusations of black people. This has a long historical tradition.
As we wrap up, what can we learn today by talking about the Emmett Till case and by looking at this investigation now reopened by the Justice Department?
Okay, it seems to me that there are several issues involved. I think one of them is, what we expect from the justice system. The other, I think, is to learn, what some of these historical continuities are. For example, as I mentioned, one of the things that the Brown decision and the Till case represented was a changed attitude toward black children. We find ourselves today in a situation where the country no longer has much of a commitment to the integration of public schools, in which discriminatory treatment of minority children has been noted, as well as the so-called prison-to-pipeline, school-to-prison pipeline, where children are essentially cast off and relegated to marginality in American society. So I think one of the things that the United States must do is to confront its historical past and to consciously make efforts not to repeat these errors.
We'll leave it there for now. Brenda, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
That was Brenda Gale Plummer, professor of history and African American studies at the UW-Madison, with us to talk about the life and legacy of Emmett Till, with the news that the U.S. Justice Department is reopening Till's murder case. First, with so many recent controversies centering on sexual harassment of women, the Me Too movement is front and center in many conversations in the workplace and online. Our next guest wanted to know how men feel about this. They conducted a survey of over 1,600 men, asking them about their ideas of masculinity, intimacy, and how, if at all, the Me Too movement has changed how they see things. Ella Cousy is a visual journalist for 538.com. Ella, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having us. Rob.
And Anne Maria Barry Jester is a reporter at 538. Anne Maria, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, Rob. Thanks.
Well, Anna Maria, first, what were you looking to find out in this survey?
Yeah, so, like you said, we started having a conversation with this radio show, Death, Sex, and Money, from WNYC, it's one of the public radio stations in New York, about all these sort of many things that were going on that were talking about men, right? So sexual harassment allegations, the Me Too movement, gender disparities in the workplace, and we kind of wanted to know, what did that mean for men's perspectives on masculinity, and so we decided to create a survey asking men what it means to be a man today.
And Ella, can you give us a sense of some of the questions, the range of questions that were asked before we dig into the fine details here?
Sure. So the survey was broken up into pretty much four sections. The first was sort of general ideas about masculinity or, what it means for these men to be men. Kind of general questions about being a man in society. The next section was about their day-to-day life, things that are on their minds, things that they do. And then there was a section on workplace interactions, not all about Me Too specifically, but we do ask about Me Too, ask if they've heard of it, and then sort of if anything, trying not to, when we write these questions, try not to presume anything about the people reading them, but kind of leave it as open as possible. So asking if they've heard of Me Too, and if so, has that changed their behavior? And then there's a section on relationships, romantic relationships primarily. Again, both generally and then in the context of Me Too. And then at the very end, there's a section about demographics. So we collect information on the survey respondents that help us draw sort of comparisons across age, across demographic groups, stuff like that.
And Anna Maria, let's start with awareness of the Me Too movement, because sitting from the perspective of somebody in the media, it seems like it's all over the place. And if we're, following the news on Twitter and places like that, it seems like it's all over the place. How aware were the men you surveyed of this movement trying to draw attention to issues of sexual harassment and more?
Yeah, that's a great question, and was one of the things that really stood out to us in the responses in the survey. So, you know, the vast majority of men had heard of Me Too, 75%, but there was a full quarter of the 1,600-plus respondents who said that they hadn't heard of Me Too, which is very, very interesting because, as you said, it is sort of all over the news. But, it's important to remember that people get their news from different sources and everyone's not paying attention to the same stuff. And so there's, I think it says a lot about sort of the nature of these conversations, which is that they are happening, they're influencing some communities, but also very much not necessarily so present in others. Of the men who said that they had heard of Me Too, about one in three said that they thought about their behavior at work differently. So it was pretty influential for about a third of the people who had heard of Me Too. But there was a full quarter that said they hadn't heard of it.
And Ella, on that first section about masculine identity, what it meant to be a man or manly, what kind of things stood out to you in the results?
Yeah, so probably unsurprisingly, a large majority of men, 80% said that they felt masculine or somewhat masculine, but a much smaller percentage cared about what others thought of it. So we were sort of interested in that difference between individual feelings of like, if you're a man in society today, it's important that other people see you that way. But then we also asked, and this was another really interesting finding for us, whether men felt that society put unhealthy pressure on them. And a really strong majority said that they did, again, about 60%. But we also asked for sort of, we had like an open-ended, why do you think so? And the responses were really divergent. So some men, like a lot of those responses were, men can't be open about their feelings, there's too much pressure to be masculine, so on and so forth. But then a whole another section was sort of in the, men aren't allowed to be men today. There's too much emphasis on feelings or too much trying to make all the genders the same. So, when you write these surveys, you are trying to account for everything and you can't always ahead of time. So that sort of piqued our interest and I think, points to a divide in our society and a possible future area of investigation.
Talking to Ella Cousy and Anna Maria Berry Jester, both with 538.com, looking at their new survey of men about men, about what it means to be a man, about values of masculinity, and about the Me Too movement. Anna Maria, on questions related to male identity, what it means to be a man, did you see generational differences between younger and older men?
Yeah, that was really interesting. Not necessarily surprising, but, we asked men, first of all, where they thought they got their ideas about masculinity and what it means to be a good man from. The largest number of people answered that it was a father or father figure, 64%. But a pretty good share of men, 40%, said that a mother or mother figure was really influential in how they thought about their masculinity and where they got their ideas about being a good man from. Many people also cited religion. So there were these generational differences, though. So pop culture, for example, was a source of inspiration for a much greater share of the younger men in the survey, about 40% of those 18 to 34, but only 17% of men ages 35 to 64. So, understandably, pop culture is a little more influential among younger generations than it was among older generations.
Ella, in the workplace portion of the survey, there was an interesting series of questions asking men if they felt advantaged or disadvantaged in the workplace based on various things about being a man and whether women were hurt or harmed in the workplace. What kind of things stood out to you from that section?
Yeah, what was really interesting about both of those questions is that there was so the first question was, how would you say it's an advantage to be a man at your work right now? We were trying to be specific to the person answering the questions, their workplace, not like in general. And then, would you say it's a disadvantage to be a man? How would you say it's a disadvantage to be a man at your work right now? And what was interesting about those is there was a none of the above response or a no answer response. And for both, that was an extremely popular answer. You know, people, a lot of the men said there were no disadvantages and there were no special advantages to being a man. However, almost 60%, 59% said that there was no advantage to being a man. But fewer than that, so a majority said there was no advantage to being a man, but a majority said there was a disadvantage to being a man at the workplace. So, you know, a lot of these conversations that are happening in the news media are about the effects of women in the work right now, which is like obviously sort of the point of the Me Too movement and not something that we want to gloss over at all. But from a man's perspective, we thought it was really striking that a lot of these men are more likely to see disadvantages for themselves because of their gender in a workplace than advantages. And one of the really common ones that people cited, that these men cited as a disadvantage, was there was a greater risk of being accused of sexual harassment, or which was 42% of the respondents, and also a greater risk of being accused of being sexist or being racist, and that was at 38%. So those are pretty sizable, you know, shares to select that response.
We're talking about masculinity and what men think it is with Ella Cousy, visual journalist for 538.com, and Anna Maria Berry Jester, reporter at 538. They're sharing the results of a survey of over 1,600 men. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What does manhood or being masculine, acting like a man, mean to you? And has that changed in society for you personally since the Me Too movement? Have men's and women's dynamics in the workplace changed in your eyes in recent years? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We've heard some comments there already. Ezra says, I think it's always been hard and confusing being a man. It's almost like walking on eggshells. You can say something that's totally innocent, be told that you're making innuendos inappropriately. Looking is inappropriate. I'm scared to death to say the wrong thing or to even initiate touching for fear of it being taken the wrong way. I fear the Me Too movement may make it worse. Dan says, the Me Too movement changes nothing. I continue to not be a jerk. If you don't know where the line is, keep your hands to yourself. Look her in the eye and talk to her the way you'd like others to speak to your mom, grandma, sister, or daughter. We'll pick up the conversation, maybe hear from you, coming up on Central Time. We continue our conversation with Ella Cousy and Anna Maria Berry Jester from 538.com. We're talking about a survey of over 1,600 men about what it means to be a man. You can see their results at 538.com. Want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Do you think the definition, the meaning of masculinity has changed or evolved in recent years? How would you define what it means to be a man? Have you changed your on-the-job behavior or thinking in recent years? And with the Me Too movement all there, all these stories about sexual harassment, sexual assault, and more, has this changed the way you think about the way men and women interact in the workplace and elsewhere? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also join the conversation over at the Ideas Network Facebook page or email us at centraltimewpr. Did you get a sense, Anna Maria, of maybe confusion over what men were supposed to be out of these survey results and some of the qualitative responses you got from people?
Yeah, I mean, I think we saw lots of places where there was a pretty big divide on how people answered questions. So, you know, we looked at dating and relationships, for example, and, you know, there seemed to be some pretty different ideas on what the roles are there. So 60% of men felt that they were expected to make the first move in a romantic relationship, but that leaves, you know, 40% that didn't think that. You know, about half of men said they always tried to pay when they go on dates. But the other half felt like maybe it depends on circumstances. There was pretty big differences in age groups there. So, you know, younger men tended to say they never try to pick up the check first. Older men tend, very, very few of anyone over age of 35 said that they never try to pick up the check first. So, you know, you can see some sort of shifts in what the expectations are there. And going back to the point we discussed earlier, I mean, it was really striking to see the pretty strong difference, and I think you hear that in some of the comments that you just read, about whether or not Me Too, the sort of growth in this conversation around sexual harassment is a disadvantage for men. I think seemed like there were a lot of men who really felt that they're walking on eggshells at work, that they are at risk of being accused of something. And then we had responses from men who, you know, really felt like the lines are very clear, it's very easy to avoid walking into trouble. And so those differences sort of spell this pretty strong tension, I think, right now about what is acceptable behavior in a workplace in particular.
Ella, I wanted to ask about issues of consent in sexual interactions, one of the hearts of the issue of the stories that came out of the Me Too movement. What kinds of things did you hear from men when it came to consent?
Yeah, so we asked men, you know, when they wanted to be physically intimate with someone, what kinds of things do you do to sort of figure out if the other party is interested? And our most, popular response at 59% was that every situation was different, which, you know, fair. But it was also a sort of choose all that apply. And so of other high percentages, the next most common selection was reading body language, which I think is such an interesting I think that's often a thing that comes up as like an example of something not to do in the news coverage. There's a lot of conversation about verbal consent and even laws that have been passed, saying that, I think in California, verbal consent, or maybe not passed, but people want to make verbal consent sort of the law of the land, whereas only 30% of our respondents said that they always asked for verbal confirmation of consent when they wanted to be physically intimate with someone. So, I think that is a topic that dominates the news media, dominates storylines, in the discussion about college campus sexual assault. I think consent comes up a lot, but amongst our respondents, only a third. So two-thirds of men did not, they're like, I don't usually ask for verbal consent. I can do it in other ways. I think this response among so many of ours just sort of shows a lag between, the kinds of discourse that dominate headlines and the kinds of choices that people are still making in their everyday lives and the ways that they navigate that.
Go to our callers at 800-642-1234. We've got Nick calling from Ohio, but from Wisconsin. Nick, hi.
Yes, sir. Hi, Rob. Yeah, I just feel like I'm being blanketed with generalizations. I think the abusers and the harassers have been a really good manipulators to make people think that all men are alike, and we need to be retrained and retaught how to be decent human beings. And it's just not the case. Being masculine is being independent, not letting other people tell you how to live your life. And that's, but it's also, being a decent human being. It's not that complicated. Thank you.
Nick, thanks a lot for the call. Anna Maria, did you get a lot of that kind of response, men fearing being painted with a broad brush, as Nick was saying?
Yeah, I think you see that a little bit in the responses about workplace harassment, which is where we kind of address some of that most directly. And, as Ella said, the most common response we got between what might be an advantage or what might be a disadvantage was it being a disadvantage that you're likely to be accused of sexual harassment or sexism or racism. And so it's, I think you see there that there are a lot of deep concerns among men that they are being accused of things that they are not, that they don't, feel that they're doing.
Ella, one common response to that concern raised by men is that we've been hearing from the Me Too movement that a lot more women have been subjected to this kind of behavior, and clearly a lot more men than previously suspected were committing this. Did you hear any of that coming out in your survey results?
Yeah, I mean, we didn't ask about that in particular. We tried to keep questions focused on sort of, the experience of the men we were serving rather than their, like, general opinions on the Me Too movement. You know, more so, for example, our question was, for those who have heard of the Me Too movement, has it changed your behavior? And if so, how? And so, you know, we didn't get responses that were like, women are lying or anything like that. It was more sort of a lot of men, and this sort of aligns with what your caller suggested, a lot of men said that they didn't change their behavior, you know, and then the responses were sort of like, it's not, you know, as long as you're respectful, it's fine. I don't have to change my behavior. Which is, you know, interesting. That's why we conducted this survey, to sort of see, in this climate and this particular moment, is this creating broad change for men as well as women, or are men mostly going about business as usual? And it seems to be, for a lot of men, it's the latter.
Go ahead.
I'm sorry. Among the employed men, we also asked them if they'd heard or seen sexual harassment at work, and if so, how they responded. And 75% said they hadn't witnessed sexual harassment. When you look at surveys around women, you know, the responses from women who say they have, who've been asked if they've experienced sexual harassment in the workplace, there seems to be some sort of, there's a discord there. And that very well could be that men are not witnessing these things. Obviously, a lot of them happen in sort of private encounters. There's been a lot of question around what the responsibility is for men when in these interactions, even if they're not the person committing them. And, it was made me wonder, you know, if people aren't seeing things or if they don't recognize it the same way that a woman might as a problem.
As we start to wrap up, Anna Maria, looking through these results, having done this survey, what questions do these raise for you now looking ahead?
You know, I really wonder how the sort of tension gets resolved that women are, by and large, saying there's a pretty big problem in society and the way that they're being treated, and that is appears to be threatening or a problem for some men as well, and that they feel like they're being accused of things that they're not committing, which, you know, I'm certainly not arguing that the vast majority of men are or not, one way or the other, but it's that seems to be a pretty big tension there. And in some ways, you know, there's this push to try and have more gender equality, but if you have these social conversations, you know, I wonder about how that sort of causes some divides as well. It'd be interesting to see over time how some of these attitudes change.
Thanks to both of our guests for this conversation, Ella Cousy and Anna Maria Berry-Jester. They're both with 538.com. Been talking about a survey they conducted asking men about their ideas of masculinity, intimacy, and how, if at all, the Me Too movement has changed how they see things. You can still weigh in on these issues, talk about your own experiences. Do that over at the Ideas Network Facebook page. The city of Milwaukee may be on the way to getting a new flag after years of efforts from local citizens. As reported in the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, a Common Council committee will take up a measure, I believe it's today, that would make what's known as the People's Flag of Milwaukee the official flag of the city. Now here's the tale of two flags. The current flag was adopted back in the 1950s. It's designed by an alderman using elements from a lot of other proposed flags. It includes a gear, a waterfront scene, a sort of outline of a Native American, a flag, City Hall, the now-demolished County Stadium, and a lot more. It's busy. In a poll of the American Vexillological Association, a flag group, in 2004, it was voted the fourth worst flag of any major American city. It's been mocked since then, but it has its defenders. The new flag was the winner of a design contest in a field of just over 1,000 entries. Here's the official description of that new flag. The rising sun over Lake Michigan symbolizes a new day. The light blue bars in its reflection represent the city's three rivers and three founding towns. Gold represents our brewing history, and white symbolizes unity. So will Milwaukee end up waving a new flag? Only time will tell. And does your own community have a flag? If so, do you know what it is, what it looks like? I'm not sure if I do myself. I can picture the Wisconsin flag, and that's about it. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time here on the Ideas Network.